Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the UC Irvine campus and streaming live at kuci.org. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett. The show was recorded on January 29th, 2021. You can find podcasts of past shows on iTunes, Stitcher, and Amazon. And today, for the entire hour, I have with me Linnell George. Linnell is a journalist and essayist. After Image, Los Angeles Outside the Frame was her first book of essays and photography, exploring the city where she grew up. As a staff writer for both the LA Times and the LA Weekly, she focused on social issues, human behavior, visual arts, music, and literature. She taught journalism at Loyola Marymount University in LA in 2013 and was named a USC Annenberg Getty Arts Journalism Fellow. And in 2017, received the Huntington Library's Alan Jitsi Fellowship for her studies of California writer Octavia E. Butler. A contributing arts and culture columnist for KCET, Artbound, her commentary has also been featured in numerous news and feature outlets, including Boom, a Journal of California, Smithsonian, KPCC's The Frame, Los Angeles Review of Books, Vibe, Chicago Tribune, Washington Post, Essence, Black Clock, and Ms. Her liner notes for Otis Redding Live at the Whiskey A Go-Go earned a 2017 Grammy. And her newest book is A Handful of Earth, A Handful of Sky, The World of Octavia E. Butler, published by Angel City Press. Welcome to the show, Linnell.
Thank you for having me, Barbara.
Of course, of course. Let's start with you giving a brief synopsis of the book and talk a little bit about how it came about.
Okay. The book really focuses on Octavia Butler's transformation, her self-transformation into a writer from a young girl who was a, you know, voracious reader and a busy dreamer who really found herself yearning for representation in the books that she was reading. And so she started writing her own stories. And this book came out of some research I was doing for another project for a Los Angeles-based arts nonprofit called Clock Shop. And in 2016, which was the anniversary of 10-year anniversary of Octavia's death, Julia Meltzer, who runs Clock Shop, she wanted to celebrate Octavia's legacy and her life in some way, and so she thought, why don't I commission some writers and some artists to go into the archive at the Huntington Library in San Marino and see what they come up with. And so I wrote a piece for that, an essay, called Free and Clear, where it was a posthumous interview, and I put it together where Octavia was asking questions and answering her own questions, and that was taken from the archive. And I realized as I was finishing up that piece, I wasn't quite done with her. And this book, this idea started to seep through, this idea of self-creation and Octavia's way of creating her life.
Mm. I love how you include, little things that she used, you know, her notebook or a little manila envelope for ideas and her composition book cover. Talk about sort of the idea of including visuals, making it sort of a visual representation as well as written.
I was really drawn to these everyday, humble things that, you know, maybe other people would not have kept for an archive, but she did. And because they were building blocks for her, they were ways for her to do her work. She came from a family that didn't have much in Pasadena, but she made more than do. She like used these materials, like her composition books or her 10-cent notebooks that she got from a drugstore or a supermarket, her calendars that she may have gotten from the dentist or the doctor or the eye doctor, and she turned them into these really valuable tools for her writing life, her library card, her bus pass, all these little things made up who she was eventually. And the thing that really, really struck me was that she could have gotten really, she could have really gotten stuck on what she didn't have. She focused on what she had, and she made, you know, magic out of it, a miracle out of it.
It's funny, the thing that keeps coming up in some of her lists is that she wants $100,000.
Yes, she wants $100,000, and I don't know how she came upon that figure, but she felt it was going to fix things, you know, for her and her mother. She wanted to buy her mom's house and buy her mom a house and make things easier for them. And she created a contract that she would sign every day, that this was one of the wishes she had, was that $100,000 that might help pave the way.
Yeah, it's interesting. And speaking of the bus pass, it's interesting to read that she wrote on the bus and found inspiration there. And it reminded me of writers I know now that, well, at least not at the moment, because hardly anybody's flying that I know, but writers I've talked to who like to write on airplanes because it's sort of an area where there's nothing much else to do and they're inspired to get words on paper.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's like this idea that, you know, it's a downtime where you're not going to be interrupted by the usual things that might interrupt you, including yourself. You know, is one of the things that Octavia would say about, you know, working at home, which she did, was that her bathroom would be the cleanest, you know, as it ever has been, her kitchen, her floors, her this, you know, the way that we procrastinate and the airplanes and the buses, you know, like this is my downtime, my between time, and I'm going to take advantage of it as a writer.
Yeah. That's great. And your mom, it sounds like Octavia Butler originally came to you through your mother.
Yes. Yeah. She was the one who was the initial Butler fan. My mom was an English teacher, high school, and junior high school first, and then high school, and she just bought books, read books. You know, books were a huge part of my life, and she would bring extra copies of things to the classroom for her students to interest them in writing and in reading, actually, to begin with, because, you know, some kids were just like, you know, I'm not that interested. These writers don't have anything to do with me. And she could slip a book like Octavia Butler into a student's hand and change their mind about, you know, subject matter and who can be an author.
Yeah. Yeah. And did you have any inkling back then when you were exposed to Octavia Butler and read her that someday you would do a book about her?
Oh, gosh, no. I was just telling a friend last night, you know, there's no way I would have known or would have even thought to plan it. I mean, I was aware of her. I had gone to readings where she was. I covered an event, you know, events where she had been as a journalist. But that just wasn't on my path or plan, a list of things to do. You know, it was total serendipity. And once I got in that archive, I really felt like, oh, wow, I'm learning about someone's life. And there were some things that really resonated, you know, being an African-American woman who's a writer, but also just being a writer in a Southern Californian. And this part of her story, the struggle, the writing struggle, really, you know, hadn't been told yet.
Hmm. I'd love to hear you read From A Handful of Earth, A Handful of Sky.
Okay. I'm going to read a little bit from the very first part of the book, which is an introduction, and then it's sort of a why. Question. Who is Octavia Butler? Answer. I want to be someone I've never been before. Some days it had to feel like moonscape. or the outer edges of some yet-to-be-understood terra incognita. Octavia E. Butler never asked to be here, may not have picked it if she had had the druthers, but she made do. Pasadena, crown of the valley, earth. How did she, I've come to wonder, endure the atmosphere, the picket fences, the rolling manicured lawns, the uniformity, the predictability, the breezy conviviality? What was it like, Octavia, to feel earthbound? People think they know Pasadena because of television's establishing shots, the football games, the annual Tournament of Roses parade, and that famous turn at Colorado and Orange Grove Boulevards, where the extravagant flora-draped floats lurch by for their close-up, all of it backdropped by a bright blue January sky. She knows the world is conversant in this perception. Pasadena, hometown Pasadena, as she once herself quipped, where everyone is rich, right? Of course, people used to tell me this all the time. Pasadena, she was well familiar, has many guises and many faces. The ones the world sees, the others you come to know once you navigate it for yourself. Octavia Estelle Butler, science fiction writer, MacArthur genius and visionary, spent incalculable hours in the service of putting words on the page, stumbling onto a thread of inquiry, letting ideas germinate, then sail around her imagination. She dreamt of alternative habitats and fleshed out heretofore unseen characters, giving them purpose, language, and agency. Equally, if not more important, however, was Butler's time and attention to crafting her most complex and unique creation, her life. Born in Pasadena in 1947, raised by a widowed single mother who worked for years as a domestic, Butler could not have begun her journey farther from her intended destination. Known among friends and family as Estella, or Junie, she was an introspective and intuitive little girl. A voracious reader and sensitive observer, Butler lived deeply and vividly in her imagination. "I had been making up stories and telling them to myself since I was 5 or 6, she often recalled in interviews. "Because my mother, in an effort to make me read, refused to tell them to me, I did read. We were lucky enough not to be able to afford a television at the time. So I read everything I could find, from my grandmother's California farmer to some interesting pornography I found in someone's trash. But until I began writing my own stories, I never found quite what I was looking for. In desperation, I made up my own." When I am traveling through Pasadena on the brightest, hottest days, I imagine Butler standing at the bus stop on a dirt parkway, tangled with black-eyed Susans, steps away from one of her old residences on Washington Boulevard, just east of Fair Oaks, carrying her pink notebook like a shield. I imagine her standing apart, just slightly, from the knot of waiting passengers, an entire other world zooming by in her head. What does it take to create a world? A writer's world? A handful of earth? A handful of sky? And what more? It takes a notebook to write down your stories, a diary to confide in, a library card to advance your studies, a bus pass to move around to get to work, and also to get to your work and get it done, a calendar to keep track of dates and pages to create a structure for your life, a set of contracts with self to keep on path and stay accountable, a collection of advisors and consequently affirmations to pin to the wall or mirror to remind yourself to center your dreams and power, an appetite for the news to keep alert for story fodder, for inspiration that might come over the transom, a sense of your territory, actual, metaphorical, literary, and your place in the world.
Thank you so much. That was Lynelle George. Reading from A Handful of Earth, A Handful of Sky, The World of Octavia E. Butler, published by Angel City Press. I love the line. It's early on in the book. You say she gravitated towards science fiction as a genre because it lifted the ceiling and dissolved the walls. Mm-hmm. Talk about that a little bit, about her sort of involvement in science fiction and how she influenced the genre.
She became a science fiction fan through this portal of fantasy. She's reading fantasy and she was writing her own fantasies and horror stories, you know, at first. And she started to read more and more science fiction through the fantasy portal. Then she saw a movie called science fiction movie, B movie, called Devil Girl from Mars. And she talked about how horrible it was. And she was 11 or 12 at the time, and she thought, well, I could do better than that. You know, I could write something better than that. And that set her on this path of reading and writing science fiction. But she couldn't find herself in that even. But because it was imagined, she could have space to create characters who were like herself and put, and women in particular, put them in positions of power, you know, and make them protagonists and heroines and move them through time and space. And, you know, and of course they weren't perfect. And that's, she kind of, and that in a way was her way of, it was her on the page and she could write herself in. And she constantly talked about how important it was for her to write herself in because she knew that that would be valuable to other people aside from her. But when she entered this genre as a writer and she took workshops and she had to really look to find them. She was often the only black person, except she did befriend Samuel Delaney when she went to Clarion, which was the science fiction conference. And that was big for her. And I've noted recently on his Facebook, he's been talking about what it was like to encounter her as a young girl. And all of this I'm reading in the archive about how shy she was is what he saw. And he was trying to kind of coax her out of this. But she really shone bright in that situation. She may not have spoken much, but the writing really, really caught people's attention. And that was important for her to finally be in a space where people, that was one part of herself she didn't have to explain, and it was this love of creating new places and new possibilities for people like herself.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, that science fiction was liberating for her, and that she kept pushing through the fear. And there's a quote in here somewhere that seems taken from Frank Herbert's Dune about fear being the mind killer.
Yes. You're like the first person who's actually said that. And that is exactly where it's from, because that was one of the books she was reading. And then she would play with that fear hung over her life. It's one, if I do a command F to search through my transcriptions of her notes, I think fear is one of the words that comes up the most. She had to get past it, and it for most of her life, if not all of it, there were things that she was trying to slay, but fear was the biggest dragon.
She was so self-critical, and I wonder how much that helped her become a great writer. You know, usually it seems that the writers who are hardest on themselves are the better writers, because they're never satisfied, you know.
Yeah, she absolutely was driven, and she would revise and throw things away and then revise. She'd start again, and because she was doing this, especially early on her own, she didn't really have a lot. Like, she couldn't take it to a friend. I mean, there were, you can see in the archive, there were parts of her life where she had picked one or two people that she would share things with, classmates or friends. But she outgrew them. And, so she really was a taskmaster with herself. And I do think that's exactly what made her who she was, the fact that she was so hard on herself. But there were moments where I'm like, don't do this. You know, like, it's too, you're being too tough. You know, get some rest. Don't take the no-dos. You know?
Oh, man. I love her love of the library and the Los Angeles Library, which Susan Orlean made famous in her The Library book years prior, served as Octavia Butler's own personal, own personal MFA program or university.
Yes.
and then the library's on fire. She takes the bus one day to the library and gets left off somewhere else close by because it's on fire.
Yes. Yes. And she's, and she was actually on her way to do some tutoring, because that was part of what she wanted to do, is encourage writers and adults who hadn't learned to read. And so she had volunteered, and she'd run a couple of errands, and then she was waiting, and then the bus driver was like, nope, we're stopping here. And she was horrified, and she ended up going home and trying to draft something about this building, which was, and she talked about, like, she felt she was writing about the death of a friend. She was really worried that it was gone, because this was the place that served many purposes for her. It was her graduate school. It was her office. It was, where she was able to go and do research and make copies and talk to people. And she had a routine. People recognized her from the library, and this was traumatic, what had happened, because she talked about how, the library was a, open university for Americans, free university for Americans, and how if you did not have access to books and maps and archives, you could go to the library and you could read as much, and she did. I mean, and even she read herself through the Pasadena Children's Library at a very young age, then they wouldn't let her in the adult side, and she was really frustrated. So, she had a really strong relationship with the library systems.
How do you think she moved beyond the teachers who were not encouraging? I mean, she had a lot of teachers that it seemed you would think they would encourage her brilliance, but instead they really tried to discourage her. And how do you think she moved beyond that?
I think she eventually took it as a challenge, like, I will show you. But in the beginning, I know it was devastating, because she was trying as hard as she could. And it's really poignant where I looked at some of her report cards, and I could just see, like, this is beyond an uphill battle. It could have worn her out. I don't know how she steeled herself. I know that even though her mother didn't understand what she was doing, I mean, but she understood her daughter's passion. So I know that her mother encouraged her and loved her. I think that love and this inspiration that Octavia took from her mom, she worked hard and loved her, and tried to support her. And even though she didn't get it, she bought her first typewriter when she was really young, So I think those sorts of things, where she was getting the negative impressions feedback, because she was ignored sometimes too. That was the other thing. Like, sometimes it wasn't even direct. It was just like, oh, whatever, you're invisible. But I think it was, you know, knowing like I do have worth, and I'm going to just keep going, and I will show you.
Yeah, I love the bit about the typewriters. I'm a typewriter collector, and I loved seeing the little typewriter ribbon box and hearing, you know, that her mother did that for her, because, you know, how encouraging to a young writer.
Yes.
You know, I mean, now it would be a computer, I imagine, although I talk to parents who are buying their kids typewriters still.
That's fantastic.
I love that. And I was also curious how you decided which mementos of hers to include. Like you just mentioned a report card, and in the book you talk about the hundreds of boxes of her papers and things that are at the Huntington Library. And how did you decide what would go in?
Yeah, the paring down was really hard, and trying to like really stay focused on the story I was trying to tell. And I really wanted to pick the things that either she touched every day or things that sustained her through her whole life. Like calendars were really important to her, because not only did they help her plan her day and look forward to deadlines, they also were places where she kept track of her page counts, and it really provided structure. And so even if you just went in and pulled a box with her date books and calendars, you would learn so much about them. And again, she touched these things every day. Her notebooks were things she touched every day. And I really was trying to think about things that seemed really essential, even down to the bills, because the bills shaped her life too, because it's like, okay, I've decided I'm going to take this leap and be a freelancer and take some odd jobs to try to support it. But those bills kept coming, and she had to figure out a way to pay them. You know, talk about slaying another dragon, which was like just trying to like figure out, how do I keep my head above water, and how do I not worry all the time that I'm not going to be able to make ends meet, because these bills are coming in time and time again. And what's also kind of beautiful about the bills, she would write on the envelopes of the bills, you know, like pieces of stories or dialogue and that sort of thing. So again, something she was interacting with daily was, you know, the bills are here, and so is the writing, and so, you know, scratch paper.
I was thinking it almost doesn't matter whether you're an Octavia Butler fan or a fan of science fiction. I found the book really inspiring for writers and probably creators in general, but of course, writers, she was a writer.
Yes.
You know, it's like you read about a writer's life and how they got through and how they, you know, continued writing and became successful. And I found it really inspiring and interesting. For that reason as well.
I'm so glad to hear that, because that was my feeling too, because, you know, I didn't come at this from, you know, a science fiction fan standpoint, you know, or, you know, prism, you know, like my focus. But what I really did get hooked into was like, yeah, she's trying to do something that's different, that she can't always explain to other people. And all of us, you know, there's so many of us that have some part of our life that is like that. And how do you keep going, you know, and how do you make this happen? And how do you commit to yourself? How do you make yourself a priority when, you know, there's not a lot of people that necessarily, you know, will support it or understand it? You're trying to do something different. So how do you do that? And I think, as you said, I mean, it transcends, you know, genre or your interest. And, you know, I had just got an email from a friend of mine who's he's a historian, jazz historian, in fact, and he wrote me. He said, you know, I would not have picked this book up had I not known you. And then when I got into it, I thought, this has a lot of valuable things that for anybody, you know, for people like me, you know, like, you know, I'm trying to do something creative, and it can help me structure, you know, my days and help me think about what I'm doing. And that made me feel like you know, I won, you know.
Well, I mean, and it's such a beautiful, such a beautifully crafted book. And I'm so curious about Angel City Press. I think I had Pat Morrison on a couple years ago with the book that Angel City did for her. And I'm curious, I mean, it's full color, which is also kind of unusual, right, for a press to print photographs and such in color because it's expensive. Can you talk about working with them and how you found them, or did they find you? And, you know, from that
thing. So, that's such a great question, because I was looking, when I was finishing up my last book, After Image, it was the first book I was doing that was going to be a collection of photographs and essays. And I thought, okay, so I have to look for a publisher that would be ready to do that, because I was wanting to tell LA's story, you know, through images as well as reported pieces. Two friends of mine had published with them and had recommended them because of that, because they work with images, and it's a small press. And so I was getting ready to email them, and literally like maybe the day before, you know, I was had on my to-do list to do it, I heard from one of the it's a couple who runs it now, and I heard from Patty McCauley, you know, oh, I see that you've been doing this research on Octavia Butler, because I'd already started the Butler. She was, are you thinking about writing a biography or something? And I hadn't at that point, you know, I was just working on this other project. So we connected to work on the other book, and then this evolved out of that. So it was sort of kismet, you know, that it happened that way. But what I loved about working with them was that it was a very, because they're a small press, very hands-on, in a really good way. You know, there's conversation all along the way, you know, with both books. And I just felt very lucky to have a crew of people who really understood the importance of Butler, you know, in the region, and why the region itself was such an important thing to include in a story about Butler. And, you know, she grew up in Pasadena. She was paying attention to climate change really early, you know, in the 70s and 80s, and writing about it and journaling about it. And, you know, she has these little notebooks, and there's one of them in there called Walk Thoughts. Yeah, she was like looking at like, oh, you know, the persimmons, you know, they're not ripening as early, or that this isn't blooming the same way. And she was charting this stuff. So, you know, it was really important. This backdrop of Southern California was really important to her. And, you know, as we look at these books now that are getting a lot of attention, you know, the Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents, that's drawn from this climate and this backdrop.
Interesting. I'm going to have to check that out. You are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM at UC Irvine. I'm with Lynell George. Her book is A Handful of Earth, A Handful of Sky, The World of Octavia E. Butler, published by Angel City Press. You know, I love the way you put together sentences. The writing is just so crafted. And as I was reading, I, of course, was wondering what your process is like and whether these sentences come out so perfectly the first time or what. I mean, can you talk a little bit about how you write and revise?
Yes. it was a challenge with this, because I realized from the very beginning I wanted her to be the centerpiece of this book. And so in a way, it wasn't so much that we were co-writing, but I was going to have to figure out a way to merge our voices. And that was like a bigger challenge than I thought about in the beginning. Like, because the first piece I did was just in her voice. And it was a splicing together of her talking to her, interviewing herself. And then, but I guess that time of really spending time in her voice and learning her rhythms and the way she saw things helped. So when I started writing, that was the hardest part. Like, okay, what part do I start first? Do I start with me? Do I start with her? You know, like, and so what ended up happening, I was away getting ready. I was going to teach a writing workshop, and I had some downtime, and I was away from my distractions and my procrastination, and I just got out a notebook, and I just started imagining Octavia standing at the bus stop in Pasadena with her notebook, and I just got in her head, and I just forced myself to sit and write, and just from her head, just looking at Pasadena, being on the bus, being on this, just so that it was me, but it was through her eyes. And that's what started this. Now I can see, it got me on the road of being able to see, okay, this is how I can do it. You know, I'm just going to inhabit her. And then I had to, of course, go back and separate us. But I didn't want it to be, I didn't want the reader to feel kind of jerked out of her voice and then into my voice. So yeah, it did take some revising to get it to where she's showcased, but I do have to lead. I have to lead us through, you know, because I'm looking at her too. I'm telling you about her.
Did you have an audience in mind when you were writing, or a reader in mind that you were writing to?
That's a really good question. I think I was writing to her, and I was also writing to the one beautiful, really beautiful thing that has happened out of that archive is I feel like there are a group of us now that know each other and have become friends. And it's almost, she was so isolated and self-isolating. You know, she jokingly would say, you know, I'm a hermit in the middle of Los Angeles. But she was, because she chose to stay in and work. It didn't mean she didn't have a social life, and it didn't mean, I mean she was, but she really yearned for community. And the beauty of all of this has happened is that we've all become connected around her. And so in a way, sometimes when I would get stuck with something, I would be having a conversation with one of the people that I have been interacting with over the last few years about her, and I would tease things out that way. But also I was really thinking about, you know, people who don't know her, and I'm introducing them to her, and who is she? Who is this, you know, quiet, self-effacing person who has all of this energy and vividness inside of her that you wouldn't know? How do you paint that? So I was also thinking about that too, and thinking, you know, your job is to introduce her as well, you know, and again, talking to her, you know, so there was a lot of stuff going on as I was crafting.
I love the image of toward the end of the book, you write about your mother taking you to one of her readings or events, and you're sitting, you were a teenager, sounds like.
Yeah.
Sitting
yeah.
in front of her. And I love that image of, you know, you sitting there listening and how she was just very, it sounds like she was very, I don't know, approachable, gentle, and yet kind of introverted.
Yes. What really stayed with me too about that was she, you know, I remember I saw her arrive, you know, to the bookstore, and she had her purse, and you know, that was the other thing, is like being able to see this is a working writer who's just arrived, probably just got off the bus, and you know, and put her things down. And when she stood in front, and she just said, you know, I don't read, you know, I don't do readings. You know, I talk, you know, I'm more comfortable doing that. Later, you know, she would say that she was dyslexic and couldn't read, you know, in that form, you know, out loud and mm-hmm. to a public audience. But I remember thinking, oh, okay, she's going to take me someplace and she's going to do this in a different way. And I loved how casual that was, and it made it more intimate. And yeah, and it was the first time I'd seen her, you know, too. And this voice that comes out, you know, she was so tall, and I'm tall, so I was like, she's taller than I was, you know. So just taking that all in, and I vividly remember that evening.
Mm. Is there a favorite book of hers, or one you'd recommend to people who've never read her?
I was saying to one of my editors, you know, we were talking about this, and I feel like there's so many different experiences you can have with Butler. My entry was with Kindred, and it's the one I give to people who think they may not be able to read. They're worried about reading science fiction, and it's not science fiction in that strict sense. And she even said, she goes, you know, I consider it a dark fantasy. You know, mm-hmm. it's more, there's no science in it. There's no machine, you know, it's time travel, but there's no machine. It's history, you know, really, but it's tweaked. For other people, I would say, who are really interested in what we're living through right now, I would say Parable of the Sower, because it's, you know, 2020s, 2030s, and we've got climate issues, we've got political chaos, we've got just all this stuff. It's like, and that's when people start, you hear people saying that Butler was prescient. This is the book they're talking about. And then for people who are wanting to feel like, just want to dip in and see, I would recommend Bloodchild, which is a collection of short stories and essays. And what I love about it, too, is that she writes a little afterword after each piece, where so she's interacting with the story. So it's almost as if you're getting a talk with her.
Mm, great. Curious, what drew you to nonfiction?
I'm sorry?
What drew you to writing nonfiction?
The short answer is I actually did start as a fiction writer. You know, that's what I, you know, I was started writing really young too, writing little short stories, writing what I thought was a novel. I don't know. But I think the nonfiction part must have really sunk in college. I was taking a magazine writing class at LMU with Carolyn C. Mm-hmm. And I decided I wanted to do something really ambitious. I wanted to write about the Arts District in L.A. before it was formally called the Arts District in L.A. And these artists who had been squatting in these old factory buildings that were not zoned for living. And I had met this woman who, when I was working, my part-time job was working in a bookstore, and she worked across the way at the old Broadway department store. And I loved her stories, and I pitched this to Professor C, and I put together this piece, and I was really nervous about it because I had taken like an intro to journalism class, and that was it. I wasn't on any papers or anything. And when I got the paper back, she had written in the margins, you could publish this. And I think that's what made me start to think in a more formal way about, oh, I can use, because I wrote it in like a narrative journalism way, so scenes and voices, mm-hmm. and I think that's what shifted my writing path.
Did you take
into nonfiction?
Yeah, it sounds like the fiction background probably helped you to write in that way, I would think.
Exactly. I thought, oh, I can put these two together. And I don't think I, even though I think it, at that point I was reading, you know, I mean, I'd read Rolling Stone and would become this, like, you know, for not just the music pieces, but, you know, the news pieces. And also, I was reading, you know, the alternative papers. I was reading the LA Weekly and I was reading LA Reader, but I hadn't put it together. You're like, oh, you might want to do this.
It's funny. It's wonderful when we have people that can direct us. And Carolyn C. was such a generous writer and teacher. She just,
oh my gosh, you know, she really just, was.
Oh yeah. She was on the show a few times and came down here to do a speaker series event with us, you know, maybe a year or two before she passed away. And she was generous right up to the end, right? I mean, mm-hmm. she was just a great person, great, great person.
You know, and it was, I felt like, and I still haven't been able to, I kind of want to write about this too, because I was able to reconnect with her years later when I started teaching, and you know, we've been in touch, but when I started teaching, we would go out and have dinner. Like, I would leave campus, go pick her up in Santa Monica, and we would go and have dinner at one of her favorite restaurants, Lula's, and sit and talk about books and other things, you know, writing and the world. And I really liked that ritual, and it was so nice to get to know her in this other way. And you're right. She's always so generous, and she was very concerned. She said, you have to make sure you balance your life out, and you can't just be working all the time, and you can't be, but she was the person that really taught us as students how important it was to have community. And so that was part of, and I remember from her class, is that part of your grade was going to readings, you know, going to activities, creating a community. Like, that was part of your grade. That's how that was factored in. And that stayed with me too.
In her Making a Literary Life, she harangues her readers to write charming little notes.
Yes. Right? That's right.
Every day, write a note every to day. Somebody.
Every day. That's right.
Oh, man.
Right? And I wish I did that more, but I'm trying to. I'm trying to, you know, remember, like, email. We can do that, you know.
Right.
Thank someone. Tell somebody you wrote something, you know, that they wrote something that mattered to you. It matters.
Yeah, it does. We have a few minutes left, and I wonder if you have any advice or tips or pearls of wisdom for the writers who are struggling through a project.
You know what I've learned, especially during this time where I've had so many different things to do, like you're working on different sized projects. I think the thing is, to break things up into pieces. And rather than looking at the big, huge thing that you have to complete, and this is really what I've been doing, and I started by, I guess, while I was working on the book, because I finished it during COVID, then that was crazy. So my mind was not where I wanted it to be. My focus wasn't. And really, it was in, like, some days, 500 words. Some days, 1,000 words. But I didn't make myself go, you know, you have to write 2,000 words today, and they have to be perfect. I really did do 500, 1,000, until I could get momentum. But whenever you start to, you know, freak out and feel like, I cannot do this, remind yourself you can. You've been. Just break it down into something that feels, you know, manageable. And that's what I've been doing through, you know, this crisis, is like, so much else does not feel manageable. Let's just do something that does. And let's not be so hard on ourselves.
What do you do when you hit a wall? What do you do when I don't know. I don't want to call it writer's block, because I don't really quite mean that. But, you know, you're working on a project and you just don't know which way to go. Will you just, like, go out for a walk? Will you go have, well, I guess now we can't go out to dinner exactly, but you know.
I know. Yeah, and that's the thing. Yeah. The things we used to do. What I have been able to try to do, yeah, usually moving around, you know, walking, absolutely, and being outside, you know, if, you know, has really helped because it just shifts. The other thing that I forget, and I, you know, some of my former colleagues from the paper, when we were talking on the phone, is like, put it away, you know, just go to sleep. You know, just try tomorrow, you know, because sometimes the things that I cannot solve and I'm trying so hard and I'm working another extra hour to solve, if I just had tried the next morning, it would be right there. Mm-hmm. I'm just tired. You know, some of it is I'm just tired. And, you know, and then if it really is, if it's something that you're working on with someone, like I'm getting ready to turn something fairly large and I don't know if it's going to go in today. It may go in on Sunday. I'm not sure yet. And this is why, you know, I'm thinking, do I keep it or do I now let it go to the set of eyes that I trust to take a read and make sure, because maybe I'm going to cut the things that they want me to keep. So sometimes it's trusting that you've taken it as far as you can right now, and now you just need the input from someone else to, you know, it's you've done your work. So there's that too.
Yeah, that's
that you may not be as blocked as you think you are. You know, right. You really may be done. Yeah.
Yeah, time to just take a break.
Yeah, exactly. Take a break. Be fresh.
Yeah. Well, it's just been great talking to you, and I really love the book. I think I read it in one sitting yesterday morning from 5 a.m. on, or whatever time I woke up, and I don't know. It's great. It's beautiful, beautiful presentation. So thank you very much for taking the time today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for such thoughtful and you know, caring questions and being such a careful reader. I really appreciate that.
You're so welcome. And I've been talking with Lynell George. Her book is A Handful of Earth, A Handful of Sky, The World of Octavia E. Butler. Check it out. Angel City Press did a beautiful book, and the writing is just wonderful as well. So really encourage every writer out there to check it out. We'll be back next week. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Thank you so much for listening.
Words in the same way, though my hands are moving. On the walls and crayons on the floor, tears in her eyes, she doesn't know what I'm screaming for. But look at what you've done and how I'll have to clean. I'm yelling at a face that just wanted to be seen. She sees me. Oh, now she sees me. There's people trapped in the church, running out of air, held there by the faith who weaponized their prayer. His dad, who sent his son to die. If violence counts as violence, you should pluck out both my eyes. And maybe then you'll see me. Maybe then you'll see me. Till we're free.